It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many scientists believe that our planet is now in the midst of its sixth mass extinction of plants and animals. But this mass extinction is different from the others. It's not the result of an asteroid or massive volcanic eruptions. Instead, it's almost entirely the result of the behavior of one species. Humans. This hour, we'll talk about the threats to biodiversity on our planet and in the state of Iowa. And with me this hour are three experts who can give us insight into Iowa species and what's going on. Rebecca Christoffel is here. She's a wildlife biologist and collaborator with Iowa State University's Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management. She's also president at the Snake Conservation Society. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Katie Reeder is also here. She is State Wildlife Action Plan Manager with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hello, Katie.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And also, Andrew Forbes is here. He's a University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Biology and Co-Academic Coordinator of the U of I's Environmental Science Program. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you for being here today. And extinction is nothing new on our planet. It is happening all the time, but the pace has quickened. And Rebecca, can you start us off by helping us understand the overall picture of what we're discovering now?
Well, there have always, as you say, been extinctions in the past. And, you know, the estimates for what the background rate of extinctions have been have varied. But one figure that I see quite often is, you know, one species going extinct annually as a background rate. It is estimated that at this time, it's more like 1,000 to 10,000 times that rate. So the rate of extinctions is just incredibly higher right now.
So the pace has quickened. Do we know how long it has been going on at this rate?
That I do not have knowledge about how long it's been going on at that rate. But we know that this is fairly recent. Part of the issue is one of the things that we don't know a lot about is how many species are out there. So we usually talk about what we do know. What we often don't talk about is what we don't know. And I'm sure Angela will get to this in much greater depth than I can. But insects are one of the groups for which we really don't have a whole lot of knowledge. There are many, many undescribed species that are waiting to be described. And, you know, the smaller the animal is and the more limited range or distribution on the planet that the animal has, the less likely it is to be known to us and to be described to us. So that's the other part of the equation.
Right. When we talk about extinctions on our planet, I mean, we tend to talk about what Jim Pease likes to call the charismatic megafauna. We talk about polar bears and we talk about black rhinos. But Andrew, maybe you can fill in the picture a little bit for us. There are so many species that, A, we don't talk about, and B, many of us have no idea are out there, and even scientists don't necessarily know they're
right
out there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And insects are a really good example because they're really like the 99% for animal species. There are we've described about a million of them, and we don't even know what percentage of the total that represents. So you see estimates of the low estimates are somewhere around 7 to 8 million species. I've seen estimates up to 30 or even 100 million species. And the truth really is that we don't know because we don't have the resources to catalog all that diversity. So we don't know how many there are, and we don't know how many we're losing or how fast we're losing them.
Insects have been getting more attention lately because we are becoming concerned about pollinators and the disappearance of pollinators. But of course, pollinators only represent a small portion of the insect world.
Yes, that's right. It's good that we're concerned about pollinators, and it's good that that gives us a reason to be concerned about insect diversity generally. I think we should be concerned about all the insects and all of life, of course.
Well, and Katie, let's take a look at Iowa here, because in Iowa, when the settlers moved into the state, so many species disappeared from the state of Iowa so quickly. When we talk about species that are native to Iowa, species that should possibly be in Iowa today, when do we start? How do we define native?
Well, that's a good question, Charity. We tend to look at the, you know, record, the historic record, and when species were described being in Iowa, either through sometimes we have specimens in an actual sort of cataloged or library, but sometimes we just have to go off written reports. So if a species was known to be in a fair number of counties, and we have more than, you know, just a handful of reports, we tend to think of it as at least, you know, being a native Iowa species. Right. And you're right, we've lost quite a few, especially in that time since settlement.
And there have been some amazing comeback stories, but we also have so radically transformed the habitat in our state that there are some species. I mean, obviously, there used to be wolves in Iowa. There used to be cougars in Iowa. There used to be bears in Iowa. And these are very rare visitors to the state these days.
Exactly. Yeah, it's hard to think about, you know, how we're doing today without kind of putting it in that context of what the, sort of the settlement of the state did to the landscape. You know, Iowa used to be about 2/3 tall grass prairie, you know, 23 million acres or so of tall grass prairie, 7 million acres of forests and woodlands and savannas in the east, and then kind of stretching up along the major riverways, and 4 million acres of prairie pothole wetlands, especially in the northwest, sort of north central portions of the state in the Des Moines Lobe. Another million or so acres were large rivers, backwaters, oxbows, sloughs. So you can tell by looking out at the landscape today, it's, you know, it's been drastically changed. It's been estimated that the state has been the state that has undergone the most landscape alteration in any of the U.S.
So it's a very, very different place. And you were talking about all of the different ecosystems that were in Iowa. Let's talk a little bit about plant diversity as well, because when you think about all of those different ecosystems, not just the insects, not just the amphibians and the reptiles and all of the mammals that lived in those environments and the birds, of course, but all of those plant species. And we don't have a good idea of what has been lost as far as plant species diversity, do we?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, by the time people started cataloging the diversity, you know, a lot of the losses may have already occurred. So there's the potential that there's a lot more that we lost before we ever even started paying very much attention.
So we're living in a very altered landscape, but let's try to get a picture of how the species that are living in this altered landscape are doing. And Rebecca, I know that obviously you're the president of the Snake Conservation Society, and you have a soft spot for snakes and other critters along those lines. Let's talk about how frogs and salamanders and reptiles are doing.
Well, you know, when it comes to those groups, so these aren't the groups that generally we have lots of really good information on. What I would like to say is that when it comes to frogs and toads, what's been great is that many states have what they call a volunteer frog and toad calling survey, which is the main way in which they keep track of their frog and toad populations. And many states have been doing this for 20-plus years. And so, you know, you can get somewhat of trend data. So are the populations increasing, decreasing, or staying the same? And it's a mixed bag, which isn't at all surprising. What is common to those animals that do well and are less likely to become rare or extirpated, that is, you know, become extinct in a specific area like the state of Iowa, even though they have a much greater range, is that those animals that are successful are generalists and they are opportunists. So they're not fussy about where they live. They're not fussy about what kind of food they eat. And when a new place opens itself up, a new place becomes available to them, or a new food source becomes available to them, they readily exploit that new habitat or that new food source. with animals that are likely to become rare, endangered, extinct, those are animals that are specialists. Those are animals that are really fussy. And one of the prime examples that I can give you of that is something like the Graham's crayfish snake, which I just want to eat crayfish. You know, I don't want to eat anything else. Well, that what that means is you need to have places that are good habitat for crayfish and that support healthy populations of crayfish so that Graham's crayfish snake can eat these animals. But if you give that animal some other type of prey item to eat, it's going to turn its nose up on it, you know. So you think about a fussy eater in terms of a child, right? All I'll eat are chicken McNuggets, and if we don't have chicken McNuggets, that's it, I'm not eating. That's the kind of animal that doesn't do so well, or an animal that is highly reliant on one particular kind of habitat. So you hear a lot about grassland birds. They need big grassland areas in which to nest and to raise their young. So they're going to have a harder time than a bird that's going to make do with whatever kind of habitat is available to it.
Andrew, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I think that distinction between generalists and specialists is really important. And certainly we see it in the insects as well. If you just take one species of plant, there are many, many different species of insects associated with that plant. And many of those might be specialists to the extent that if you take that plant away, all the insects go away too. And so you get these when a plant or some important organism like that goes extinct, you actually get these extinction cascades. So you lose a whole big section of your system all in one go.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back to talk more about extinction, about biodiversity, and also the state of Iowa. With me in the studio today, Andrew Forbes, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Biology and Co-Academic Coordinator for the U of I's Environmental Science Program, Katie Reeder, State Wildlife Action Plan Manager with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and Rebecca Christoffel, who, among other things, is the president at the Snake Conservation Society. We'll continue our conversation in a moment, and you are welcome to join with your questions and your comments at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many scientists believe that our planet is now in the midst of its sixth mass extinction. We're talking about that problem today and biodiversity on our planet and in Iowa. With me, I have Rebecca Christoffel. She is a wildlife biologist and collaborator with Iowa State University's Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management, Katie Reeder, State Wildlife Action Plan Manager with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and Andrew Forbes, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Biology and Co-Academic Coordinator of the U of I's Environmental Science Program. You're welcome to join the conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So we've talked about the fact that scientists estimate that we're now losing species at 1,000 to 10,000 times the normal extinction rate, or that background rate of extinction. That's a big gulf, which shows us what we don't know about what's going on right now. We've also talked about the fact that humans are the species on this planet that seems to be behind this extinction rate. And Mark from Des Moines has a question about that. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, you just touched on it. As our human population seems to be growing, our little feathered friends and insects seems to be shrinking. Now, we don't know what all the interrelation is between all of these insects and animals is that helps make our life possible. And I'm wondering how much concern there is for that.
Well, that's the concern that brought us all here today, Mark. But let's talk about the human behaviors that seem to be causing these extinctions. It's not just that there are so many humans on the planet, but what is happening because of our species that seems to have increased this rate of extinction? And Katie, I'll let you start.
Okay, well, yeah, Mark makes a good point. I mean, all humans rely on nature. So, when we don't even understand those complicated relationships. That's a really good point. You know, there's a huge variety of things across the globe that are going on. You know, humans, you know, we need space in order to produce agricultural crops to feed people. We need fresh water for drinking. We exploit energy resources so that we can power our lives, basically. So there's a whole variety of things. We also do things that that are unintended in terms of we move invasive species around, you know, in ballast water of ships or things like that. We introduce things to places where they were not native, and then they have an easier time wreaking havoc, basically taking over and exploiting the resources in their new land because they don't have their natural predators around. So there's a whole variety of things that human impacts on ecosystems, basically, that we need to solve. You know, it's a shared responsibility, and it will require some change.
Well, you mentioned the altered environment in Iowa. I mean, that's one of the main things that humans do. We alter our environment, and that has had an incredible impact on habitat, hasn't it, Andrew?
Yes, that's right. And in particular, we know that one of the major threats to biodiversity is landscape change. So, in every natural habitat, you have vegetation and then the things that eat that vegetation and the things that eat them and so on and so forth. And when you remove that diversity of plants or primary producers, you remove everything that depend on them. And the worst is when you take away vegetation from biodiversity hotspots, these areas in the world where you have these big concentrations of biodiversity, and then you cut down those forests or you remove those prairies or what have you, and basically everything is gone. And so that's a big thing that we're doing. Of course, climate change is a big problem as well. As temperatures and climate generally changes, species often can't keep up, and so they either move with the climate, or they go extinct.
So we have habitat loss, we have global climate change. But Rebecca, I want to return to the frogs for a moment. For a long time, people have been talking about amphibians as being sort of the canary in the coal mine, as far as telling us about places where pollution has gotten to the point where either it no longer supports these species or it alters these species. How significant is pollution in this picture?
Well, that's a good point that you make. And the fact of the matter is that it's important, but I don't know that it's more important than, say, the fact that we have loss of habitat, or that it's more important than, say, climate change. We have some sources of stress on animal and plant populations that are more or less what I would consider to be predictable, things like loss of habitat. You know, you can predict that that's going to happen when there is a plan to suddenly take forest and cut down all the trees or convert it to some other land use. There are other things that happen that are less predictable. I don't think anybody predicted the fact that we would get white nose syndrome introduced into North America and in the course of less than 10 years have it go from being known to affect one cave in the Albany, New York area to affecting bat populations in over 20 states, 5 Canadian provinces, and making it so severe that it's estimated that more than 6 million bats have succumbed to the disease. So we have those predictable sources of our behaviors that impact biodiversity. But then we have the things that are not so predictable, right? It's now believed that white nose syndrome was accidentally introduced into North America on the equipment or clothing of cavers who had been visiting Europe. When it comes to amphibians, we've got what we call chytridiomycosis, a chytrid fungal disease that has severely impacted those populations. And most recently, including in the state of Iowa, populations of snakes are being impacted by a fungal disease that they seem to get when they're in hibernation or slightly before hibernation, and then they either die during hibernation or shortly after emerging from hibernation, and they have the visible fungal growths on them. So there are lots of different things happening, and I think that we shouldn't overlook the fact that we have what I call multiple stressors, which are impacting these populations and making them less resilient, less able to deal with a further blow, you know, the loss of another pond or the introduction of a disease. So there are multiple factors playing on these populations.
Andrew, you wanted to add something?
Well, I think the point about introduction of pathogens and pests is really important. And something that I think a lot of people can see is the movement of the emerald ash borer across the United States and its threat to our ash trees. And then historically, of course, the loss of the American chestnut, which was one of the most important trees in North America, or at least the eastern part of North America, completely wiped out by a pathogen brought over from another continent.
There are a lot of people, and we've talked a lot about habitat loss, and there are a lot of people who, on at least a small scale, are working to create new habitat for wild creatures and also to introduce more biodiversity as far as plants go on their own property. Andrew, I want to talk about some research that you've been doing recently about insect population and diversity among insects. And you've focused this research on in cities, on certain species of trees and the insects that do or do not live there. What have you found?
That's right. So first of all, I want to say this is research my graduate student has done. I take a little bit of credit for it, but it's mostly her. Her name's Amanda Nelson. She's a great student. She's interested in the role of different types of landscapes. What the effect of different types of landscapes has on insect communities. And so what she's done is she's looked at a number of different systems where you have a plant or a tree and then an insect that lays its eggs into that tree and then another parasitic insect that lays its eggs into the larvae of the first insect. And so they're pretty simple ecosystems. And she's looked at sites all around Johnson County, so in Iowa City and then also the surrounding agricultural areas where you have trees growing in the margins and in natural areas as well, like up by the res. And what she finds is that you find trees everywhere. They grow in all of these different places. But once you get into the cities, you don't see the flies all the time. And you really don't see the wasps, these parasitic wasps. They're just gone pretty much. And the message is that, at least we think, that you can have the vegetation everywhere. You can plant trees in your yard, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's sufficient for having the natural levels of biodiversity that you'd see, say, in an old-growth forest. And that's, we don't know why that's happening. At least our lab isn't studying that, but it's a real point of concern, I think.
Is there – and I understand there are probably a lot of unanswered questions about this. When something is planted in town, let's say, you know, when the habitat was gone, the insects disappeared, something is replanted and the insects aren't coming back, is it a problem of traveling from one place to another, these islands of habitat?
Right. It may be that, and that's one of the hypotheses we're currently working from. And we're actually using some genetic methods to test that hypothesis. You can see where insects came from. Other people have studied that question, and it does look like just having a lot of built development in a city, like big buildings and then just concrete everywhere, does restrict insect dispersal. So we have reason to believe that might be the case. Other problems are, cities represent heat islands. They're usually quite a bit warmer than the surrounding area, and that can affect the phenology of the insects. It can affect lots of things about their life history. There may be more parasites. There just may be more stressors in a city that prevent them from colonizing.
Well, it's so interesting because we talk about habitat corridors quite a lot with larger species. And Katie, I know that's something the Department of Natural Resources has really focused on, creating these corridors for wildlife in the state to move around. We don't necessarily think about that with insects, but that is something that is a real problem in the state of Iowa with having these islands of habitat, isn't it, Katie?
Yeah, exactly. And for the in the recent decades, we've really focused on trying to create what we call landscape-level complexes or habitat complexes, where we try to reduce the fragmentation of the habitat within an area so that if we have an existing natural area, we'll try to build more habitat into that landscape, whether that's on private or public land. You know, we'll just try to encourage more conservation of natural areas in that landscape so that there's less fragmentation, and then we also try to work on either providing stepping stones for species to move through or corridors when possible. Even insects or plants can migrate. Just using a corridor just may take a little bit longer, for something that has to use multiple generations in order to travel a corridor. So you have to be patient.
Well, and there are some species that probably won't be able to come back. I've talked with wildlife biologist Jim Pease about prairie chickens on a number of occasions, and we just don't, even if we plant prairie and we have many acres of it, we do not have the kind of environment where prairie chickens can live and mate and travel because of these isolated habitats. I want to get to the phones before we get to our break, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Bob is on the line in Muscatine. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Yeah, my family and I have been lucky enough to be stewards of timber on the Mississippi River for about the last 80 years, and my observations have been basically we've had a renaissance in predators and mammals, which is great, but we've and the snakes and the amphibians have held their own, except for the box tortoise, they're gone. But the bad news is that our tree populations are going, especially the oaks, and that has been due, I think, basically because of overgrazing from deer. I did a short experiment on which I put out tags on the saplings of both hickory and oak trees and in ironwood, and the next spring, all the hickories and ironwood were there, but all the oak saplings were gone.
That is definitely an area of concern. Katie, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there are localized areas where deer browse can cause problems. It's not necessarily widespread throughout the state, but there can be areas of higher populations where they're concentrated. Oak regeneration is a conservation issue across the entire Midwest and actually farther east as well, due to a variety of reasons. A lot of it has to do with the fact that oaks really need to have disturbance. So they need a fire or a clear cut, or they need to be able to grow up in sunlight. And so they need a lot of open space. And they outcompete other species better when there's not a lot of shade. So as people don't burn or cut down the trees as often, or as the woodlots kind of separate into smaller and smaller segments and people manage them differently, we've had a sort of an oak regeneration issue, which is kind of a shame, too, because they also are an important food source for a lot of wildlife species.
Well, and something we talk about on Fridays a lot on Talk of Iowa, we have a lot of problems facing different species of trees. And again, many of these are introduced. And when you look back at the American chestnut or Dutch elm disease, we have oak wilt and we have, different things that are threatening many different species of trees in Iowa, in addition, of course, to the emerald ash borer.
Right. Yeah.
So that's
somebody already alluded to, I think it was Rebecca mentioned, that's on top of habitat loss, and you can think of oaks as having habitat loss too. I mean, plants exist in a certain type of habitat. On top of that, when there's all these other threats, can get very complicated. The job of conservation is a bit more complex and urgent than it has been at any time in our history, I think.
And it sounds like a lot of these problems that we're identifying are just not as simple to fix as it sounds like they could be.
Right. I mean, the scale and the complexity of the problems that face, you know, the global environment or just or Iowa's environment have increased over time. And so we've really turned to using more long-term and more large-scale approaches.
We're going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Katie Reeder, State Wildlife Action Plan Manager at the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, Rebecca Christoffel, wildlife biologist and collaborator with ISU's Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management, also president at the Snake Conservation Society, and Andrew Forbes, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Biology and co-academic coordinator of the U of I's Environmental Science Program. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about biodiversity and mass extinction on our planet. With me is Rebecca Christoffel, wildlife biologist and collaborator with Iowa State University's Department of Natural Resource Ecology and Management, Katie Reeder, State Wildlife Action Plan Manager with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and Andrew Forbes, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Biology and co-academic coordinator of the U of I's Environmental Science Program. And Andrew, you are an evolutionary biologist, and a lot of people have been asking questions this hour, sending us emails, asking questions about evolution. And this is one from Roy and Rolf. He says, what is the rate of newly appearing species, documented new species? Other people have called in and asked, you know, aren't animals and insects and plants, aren't they adjusting to the changes that are taking place in our environment? And there are. Evolution is going on all the time. There are new species arising, and that's something you can see in the insect world, right?
Sure, absolutely. And in fact, some of the work that's that we've done for a long time in my lab is looking at how insects can adapt and even form new species when new plants are introduced to a system. One of the best examples of this is apples are not native to North America. They were brought over from Europe. And when that happened, a fly, which traditionally laid its eggs in the fruits of hawthorns, which are these little North American – they're like little red fruits. Some of these flies started laying their eggs in apples. And since that time, about 200-300 years, the hawthorn fly and the apple fly have begun to diverge from one another. They're becoming new species. They have different behaviors. They're genetically different, a little bit genetically different, not completely because it's only been a little bit of time. But you can see them becoming new species. And so the answer is yes, that we can have some new species forming when we change habitats or introduce new plants to a system. But – and there's a big but – As we've said that especially for insects, every single plant that's removed from the system removes a whole bunch of other insects. So a lot of things are going extinct, and certainly the extinction rates are much, 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 much higher than rates of new species, like new diversity formation.
Well, and you mentioned 200, 300 years for these apple maggots to make this leap. And in insects, evolution happens at a more rapid pace than it does in many other species because the generations move more quickly.
Yeah, to some extent. So like something like the little flies that you get in your kitchen, they have many, many generations
a year.
Yes. Yeah. But the flies we're talking about have one generation a year. So that's about 200 to 300 generations still. So that's not very much. It's many more than we have, and then mammals and a lot of amphibians certainly. But yeah, it's, I guess the answer is yeah. They have faster evolution in the sense that their life histories are their lives are shorter.
Right, but still 200 to 300 years for
it's not very much.
Right, and when you think about the transformation that we can make in our environment, even you look at the state of Iowa and how quickly the prairie was plowed under and the state was transformed and all of those habitats were lost.
It's very disturbing. Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. Belinda's on the line in Deep River. Hello, Belinda.
Hi there. Thank you for talking about this. I'm a native Iowan. I've watched the transformation, and we just recently moved back to the state from Colorado. we're interested in, you know, doing something. We own about 80 acres of timber ourselves, but just interested in knowing what nonprofits are out there that are working towards increasing biodiversity. Any input you have on a personal level or contributing to existing nonprofits would be appreciated.
All right. Thank you for your call, Belinda. Katie, can you tackle that one?
Yeah, sure. That's a great question. There's a lot of governmental agencies and, like she mentioned, nonprofits that are out there to help, you know, private landowners make good conservation investments. And so, you know, typically we might think of if you owned farmland, you would maybe talk with someone at the Natural Resources Conservation Service or the DNR. In our Wildlife Bureau, we have private lands biologists that are aware of all the Farm Bill programs that can kind of help landowners make a whole farm, you know, conservation plan for wildlife, whatever their interests are. And in the nonprofit world, there's several, you know, there's a lot of entities that are engaged in biodiversity conservation. The Nature Conservancy, they have a strong presence in Iowa, as well as the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. It's a land trust in Iowa that's very active and works in partnership with the DNR. That's kind of the key here is that all these, with this complexity, it all takes partnerships. And so the DNR, we certainly don't do things alone. We work with the Fish and Wildlife Service. We work with the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the Farm Service Agency. And we work with, you know, the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation and the Nature Conservancy. And we work with Trees Forever. And we couldn't do conserving this state right. on our own.
So if Belinda's willing to do some research, there are people out there who can help her make a plan, right?
Yeah, and I could certainly, you know, if you take her information down, I could, you know, point her in the right direction from in terms of our private land staff.
Okay, we will do that.
Charity, can I jump in?
Please do.
Well, I would also suggest if she's interested, she can go online, and there's the Midwest Partners for Amphibian and Reptile Conservation. They've just come out with some newly revised habitat management guidelines that private landowners can use if they'd like to consider some of our less well-known and less appreciated forms of wildlife. Iowa Audubon, and there are many local chapters of Audubon. You can get people out onto your land who will happily come and let you know what sorts of birds you have using your property or that are nesting on your property and how you might manage your land to benefit the birds. And I also want to put in a plug for insects. There's a wonderful full-day program every spring in Ames, Iowa, called the Day of Insects that provides lots of wonderful information to folks who'd like to delve into insects a little bit more. And if she takes any photographs or collects any insects on her property, she can interact with lots of specialists on bugguide.net to get determinations and find out a little bit more about the particular animals she's finding on her property. So there are lots of resources out there.
So and let me ask, Andrew and Rebecca, maybe both of you can weigh in on this. We were talking earlier about how, okay, we can plant these trees, but that doesn't mean that the insects that naturally live on these trees will come. And I know that with gardening, a lot of people will make an effort to introduce beneficial insect species to their gardens. A lot of organic farmers do the same thing. Andrew, are there people making an effort to move insects around so that they are where they should be and living as they should be?
Not that I know of. I mean, as we pointed out early, we really don't know what the diversity of insects, the natural diversity of insects is. Even in North America, we don't know. We did one study where we reared parasitic wasps from one beetle that lives on maples. And we found 21 different wasp species. Only 10 of them had names. The other ones were new species. And that's incredible that there are undescribed animal species in North America. So we don't even know what's there. We can't move things around except, as you say, by introducing what we think of as beneficial right. insects. But not that I know of.
And now, Rebecca, I know you're in Wisconsin now, but when you were in Iowa, you were involved with a nature mapping program, and you had a lot of citizen scientists who were out there trying to give us information about what kinds of animals and I don't know if you did plant species as well, but what is living in Iowa? I know that that program's in question right now, but gathering that kind of information is incredibly important, isn't it?
It sure is, and just because that program doesn't exist anymore, there are lots of programs out there where people can contribute their sightings and their observations. eBird is one such program, and it has, I think there's over a million different contributors or 100,000 different contributors to eBird. It's just amazing how large these databases are getting to be. So if somebody is particularly interested in bird life, I can't think of a better site for them to go to than the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. And you can do something like Project Nest Watch or Project Feeder Watch and contribute your sightings and then compare and contrast what you're finding with other people. This is one of the ways that they have been tracking some disease outbreaks in birds, things like conjunctivitis in birds. So there are lots of opportunities for folks. I should say that the Iowa Department of Natural Resources has a couple of different volunteer monitoring programs that they run out of their agency. One is the Frog and Toad Calling Survey, and Stephanie Shepherd offers trainings each spring on that. Another is colonial nesting water birds. People can keep track of these rookeries, and I believe they also have an eagle nest voluntary monitoring program.
Yep, that's correct.
Most recently, they're starting to develop one for bats, but that will probably be a few years down the line. So there are lots of programs out there that people can contribute what they're seeing and help to monitor biodiversity in the state.
We have this email question from Cindy in Ames. It seems that the only ash trees that will survive in Iowa will be those that are made continually poisonous to insects. Do we know how many ash-dependent insect species will be extirpated as a result? I know we probably don't know, but Andrew, you want to weigh in on that?
I think that's right. We don't know, and I don't study ash-associated insects, but in general, I would expect there to be 50 to 100, maybe more species that are associated with ash trees. One thing I'd like to say, though, in reaction to that comment is that we talked about the American chestnut before. They went fundamentally extinct primarily because of this pathogen that was introduced. But some of the trees were resistant to that pathogen. And the United States cut all of the surviving trees down because they figured they were going to die. They were all just going to die. I expect that there are some ash trees that have resistance to the emerald ash borer, just that as the ash trees in their native range do. And I think that we may be losing some important diversity within the ash trees by just cutting them all down. I think that the only ones that survive may not be just the ones that we poison, but also some that have natural resistance.
And do you – well, I guess maybe this is a question for another show about whether the ones that we do keep alive will stay alive indefinitely. I mean,
well,
obviously nothing lives forever.
If only the poison is saving them, then the only way they stay alive is if we keep poisoning them.
And then the insect
then
species can't live.
Right.
On that plant
right.
Anyway.
But Andrew brings up a really good point, Charity, and that is, there are different levels of diversity. So the fact that we have genetic diversity, right, you and I don't look alike and we don't look like people that you might find in another country, means that we also have different kinds of resistance or immunity to different sorts of diseases in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just keeping all the different species out there, but keeping the genetic diversity within species present so that when a flu virus or something comes through, and if that species you know, if they're all genetically the same and they don't have immunity to that flu virus, they're all going to die. No, we want to have some so that some will survive and help to perpetuate that species.
We've spent the hour exploring this problem that we're experiencing on planet Earth, and we've really only touched the surface. We've also learned this hour that there are a lot of questions that even scientists can't answer about this mass extinction on Earth. But it's been a pretty bleak hour. Let's end on a note of hope. What do you think humans can do if we are creating this knowledge, if we can understand what's happening? What can we do to at least slow down the problem? Rebecca?
Well, I have a couple of different ideas, and we have had some great successes, things like reintroducing otters to Iowa and that, so it shouldn't be all doom and gloom and bleak. But just realizing living simply so that others may simply live is one of the mandates by which, or the tenets by which I live. And it's not just the numbers of people, but our rate of consumption that is also important in terms of minimizing our impact and thinking a little bit about what you do and what the potential impacts may be, really promoting energy efficiency and effectiveness in what we do. I know that I was amazed by one of the biggest contributions to my ecological footprint was the one or two jet trips I took a year. So just by eliminating jet travel, I really reduced my ecological footprint. That's another thing, just keeping track of how big is your footprint on the Earth.
Andrew?
I think education. I was talking to a student in our environmental sciences program the other day, and he's from India, and he was saying that one of the things he thinks can change the world is just educating everyone about the importance of the environment and how we can live sustainably and just, you know, not try to reduce our impact on the world. So a similar, you know, I guess my message is similar. We just need people to learn about what's important and how to save it.
Katie, you have the final word.
Okay. Well, I take hope from the fact that conservation is an issue that really unites Americans. It's actually considered, you know, conservation is equated with patriotism. Strong sentiments of support for conservation. Also, you know, they cut across party lines. They cut across age and gender. You know, so that's where I take my hope from, that we can work together to conserve nature.
Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Katie Reeder is State Wildlife Action Plan Manager with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you. It's been a great conversation.
Wildlife biologist Rebecca Christoffel is the president of the Snake Conservation Society. And Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Andrew Forbes, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Biology and Co-Academic Coordinator for the U of I's Environmental Science Program. Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, Dennis Reese, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.